Hi, and welcome to the Levy Institute podcast. I'm John Harvey, a professor and the Hal Wright Chair of Economics at Texas Christian University, and I'll be your host for this episode of Levy Economic Institute's podcast. The Levy Institute is a nonprofit, nonpartisan public policy research organization housed at Bard College, and this podcast is created with the goal of sharing conversations in economics and public policy that move beyond conventional approaches. Before we get started, a couple of quick announcements. The Levy Institute graduate programs in economic theory and policy are currently accepting applications. These programs offer 1 and 2 year master's degrees that give students an alternative to mainstream programs in economics and finance. To learn more, please check us out at bard.edu/LevyGrad, LevyGrad, linked in the show notes. And last but not least, the 31st Annual Levy Economics Institute Conference is coming up on May 2nd. This is a one-day virtual event diving into today's most relevant topics in economic policy and theory. The link to register will also be in the show notes. Speakers for the conference include James Galbraith and, of course, Randy Ray, who is here with me today. Hi, Randy.
Hi.
And Randy is a professor of economics and senior scholar at the Levy Institute and the 2022-23 TEPELA Distinguished Visiting Professor at Willamette University. And Randy, you were the one who initially asked if I would be willing to do these interviews, and it has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity.
Thanks for doing them.
An issue that keeps coming back up in popular discussion is Social Security, and more specifically, whether or not it can survive. There appears to be agreement in principle, if not degree, between Republicans and Democrats that we're running out of money. And I know you have quite a bit to say on this, but let me say first that one of your articles that I absolutely loved and recommended over and over was the Subway Tokens one from 1999. And I have to tell you, back then, I was still stuck on the whole, oh, we spend in deficit during recession and we spend in surplus during expansion to balance it out. And when I read that, it was one of those things, I had the same experience in understanding modern money. When I read that, I kept having to stop and think, wait a minute. That's not what I thought, but it makes sense. So I have to sit and think about it for a while, let it percolate. Well, I know you've done a lot more thinking about this since then, and particularly how MMT can illuminate the discussion. Could you first, for listeners, perhaps offer something of a summary? I know this is impossible to do in any comprehensive way, but a summary of the essential points of MMT so you can show how what MMT is before you then go on to talk about how this would be affected or how this would help us in thinking about Social Security.
A sovereign government that issues its own currency is nothing like a household or a firm. It should be obvious. And I think it was obvious to economists until the late 60s when they started applying household consumer theory to the government itself. And that's where everything went wrong. So anyway, a government that issues its own currency cannot run out. This should be obvious to everyone. Alan Greenspan has said this when Paul Ryan brought him before Congress. Paul Ryan, of course, wanted to push the idea that Social Security is going to go bankrupt. Therefore, we need to cut the benefits or, postpone retirement age, the typical things, or possibly increase taxes. Although Republicans usually don't want to do that.
Yeah.
They would rather slash the benefits.
Yeah.
So anyway, he sets up Greenspan to give the answer that, it's going to go bankrupt because Greenspan had headed the commission back in the 80s under President Reagan to drastically increase the payroll tax, supposedly to make Social Security solvent. But anyway, Greenspan says, well, no, I wouldn't say that. The government can make all payments as they come due because we can just print the money.
Yeah, yeah.
So even Greenspan said it. Now, printing the money, I don't like that metaphor because, of course, the government does not just print up cash to make its payments. It's all keystrokes today. But it's absolutely true that the government can make all payments as they come due by simply marking up the size of the accounts. So this is what MMT says, that affordability of a federal government program is never the question. The question is always the resources. Can we find the resources we need in order for the government to spend the money without it causing inflation? That's the only thing that matters. So MMT helps us to understand that. Then we focus on the things that matter.
Right, right.
Are we going to be able to find the resources we need? So the old question used to always be about the baby boomers, but that is you and me. We're there now, right? So it used to be, what are we going to do when all the baby boomers retire? How can we possibly, well, first afford it, but second, how will we be able to produce enough stuff,
right,
in order to take care of them? The first piece I wrote, I think it was in 1992, one of my first publications, was criticizing a report by the Brookings Institute with Henry Aaron. So this is way before MMT. It's just taking Keynes, who said that you cannot prepare for the future by accumulating a sinking fund. Okay, very clear, makes the argument. What is the Social Security Trust Fund? It's a sinking fund. That is not the way to prepare for the elderly. So I argued back in 92, what we need to do is just increase productive capacity to make sure that we can produce the Winnebagos that you and I want when we retire. We can't save for the future in money terms. And also, it doesn't make sense back in 1990 to produce the Winnebagos that you and I want in 2028.
Right.
Right. We can't save for really long periods of time by producing consumer goods now.
Right.
So what we need to ensure is that in 2028 or whatever year, we have the productive capacity we need to take care of the seniors.
Yes, yes.
We are aging.
Yes.
Individually and collectively.
Yeah.
And what's been in the news recently is China's population has fallen. And China is aging rapidly. China will go, so they have this measure of how fast societies age.
Yeah.
And they, so what percentage of your population is over 7%? And then how long does it take you to increase that to 14%? China will do that in 30 years.
Yeah.
The first country to achieve that was France. It took them 115 years, something like that.
Yeah.
It will take the U.S., I think, 26 years, and so on. Not the U.S., Japan.
Yeah.
The U.S. was something like 85 years to get there. But anyway, so we're aging. How can you support a huge aged population?
Right.
You will have fewer workers relative to the age.
Yeah.
China, of course, had a one-child policy.
Yeah.
So they also are going to have very few young people.
Yeah.
So relative to the aged. So you don't have a lot of people who will come into the labor force. Are you going to be able to support all of the aged people? The United States is in a much better situation because we have immigration.
Right.
If we didn't have immigration, we would look a lot like Europe, and increasing the percent of the population that is aged relative to the working population. So the question is, admitting that what matters is the real productive capacity, not the financial affordability of taking care of the elderly, is there something here we really should be scared of?
Yeah.
And I think even if we set to the side the financing part, it does not look scary on current reasonable projections. And in fact, it's a good thing. When you and I were in school, we all had to read Paul Ehrlich, The Population
Right,
Bomb,
right. Yeah.
right?
Yeah.
He predicted hundreds of millions of people were going to starve in the 1970s. The book came out in 69. So in the 1970s, we were going to have mass starvation all over the world because of the population bomb. And of course, this was right about the time China implemented a one-child policy. The birth rate had already been falling very rapidly since 1960, because China was becoming a wealthier nation and the status of women was rising. And that is what reduces fertility rates. Status of women is the best predictor. So anyway, now we are here today, and now it's the opposite. The population bomb is, uh-oh, we're shrinking. On the current projections, I think in 2080, the median projection is we're going to peak at 10 billion. And then the population may fall in half.
Really?
Okay, now if that's true, that's really good news
Yeah.
as far as human survival goes, because we can't continue to increase population. So we should be celebrating this,
Right,
right?
right, right.
But no, we're not. Now that's the median. The low end projection says in 2080 we're only going to have 6 billion.
Huh.
Okay. The high end I think is 15 billion, something
Yeah.
like that. So the range is big because it depends on fertility rates.
Right.
Of all the most populous nations, only two have a fertility rate of two or above. You need 2.1 to
Yeah.
maintain a stable population. So all of the populated nations, except those two, Pakistan and Nigeria, I think it
Yeah.
is. It's in my paper.
Yeah.
I think those are the only two that already have not reached a fertility rate below replacement.
Right.
So we're shrinking.
Huh.
So then the question is, how can you take care of the elderly? Because we're going to increase the age part of the population.
Right.
Okay, so when we focus only on age to working age, it looks tougher than if we focus on total dependents that is supported by workers. Because workers, of course, support not only the elderly, they
Sure.
also support, in real terms, the children.
Exactly.
And
Yeah.
the truth is that we already supported the highest dependency ratio in 1965,
Ah,
which was our parents,
right,
than we will ever support again. Even though we will have more elderly, we're going to have fewer children. And China is in exactly the same situation. They reached their peak dependency ratio in the 1970s. And they will only get back to that in down the road. Okay, so we've already done it, is my point. We already supported dependents, and of course, we had a rising living standard, and in many ways, that was the golden period of U.S. economic history. So there's really not a huge reason to be all that worried about it. Furthermore, labor productivity is going up. It's been going up since 1965. It becomes easier and easier. So we're going to have about one worker per dependent. And we've already done that before. And we're going to be much more productive in the future. What's the big scare? Robots are going to take away all of our jobs, right? The robots are going to be doing all that work. What if we reach the point where it's true? Robots can do everything and can provide everything that the young, the working age, who no longer have to work, and the elderly, we can produce enough to support all of them. Now, the robots don't get wages, they don't consume, and they don't pay taxes. So Social Security will go bankrupt because There's no payroll tax to collect because
Right.
no humans are working,
Yeah.
but we'll have an abundancy of output.
Right, right.
What that proves is the question is not about the financing, it's about the ability to produce.
Right.
So now, the United States, of course, is a rich country, and the living standard in the poor countries needs to rise, but their worker productivity will rise as they develop. We can share technology. We've got to take care of the elderly. We've got to take care of the young. We need to help everybody to take care of their growing elderly population. As Fag Foster used to always say, if we have the technical know-how and we have the resources, then we can always find the money to pay
Sure.
for it. We can do that across nations. We have to do it across nations in order to ensure that we move to some kind of a sustainable economy and world.
Well, a neoclassical friend of mine once talked about Star Trek Next Generation. And my gosh, what will we do once we've solved the economic problem? Because on Star Trek Next Generation, Captain Picard walks up to the replicator machine and just says, "Tea Earl Grey," which, by the way, very few English actually drink, but that's a different story. And it takes the energy from the engines, from the warp drive, and creates matter. And he's like, "Oh my gosh, what would we do?" I was like, "Well, that would be glorious." I mean, the idea that we have a situation where, and I have used Star Trek Next Generation, which unfortunately is no longer something that's relevant to my students, so I have to then explain it all. To explain, Marx's endpoint communism, where the division of labor is no longer necessary, and someone can what herd cattle in the morning and criticize poetry in the afternoon and so forth, and that is the world that we hopefully are moving towards, climate change notwithstanding, if we don't do something to ourselves in between. But absolutely, there's an episode of Star Trek Next Generation. When they, this always happens in one of these science fiction shows, they come across people from the 20th century. And there's this stereotypical Texan who's, a billionaire. And he says, well, how does somebody prove themselves in this new world of yours with all this plenty? And Picard says, well, we pursue the arts. We learn. Picard is a amateur archaeologist, and that's what he loves to do. And we explore. And what an awful world that would be. So hopefully, I don't guess we will live to see it, but perhaps our grandchildren, which brings us back to Keynes again.
That I was just going to say, that's all Keynes, economic possibilities for our grandchildren. And yes,
Right.
he suggested art and music and so on. As
Yeah.
he said, humanity is going to face a crisis. What are they going to do? We've got to keep them busy.
Yeah,
And
yeah.
so, yes, the music and the arts and
Right. And it fits in very well
primarily.
with degrowth, in terms of a new economic system. And I think the biggest obstacle, of course, will be the powers that be that are benefiting from the way the system works right now. Now, 2 years ago, you won the Veblen Commons Award that's sponsored by the Association for Evolutionary Economics. And for those that don't know what that is, it's like the Nobel Prize in economics for people who actually really do understand economics. And it's a huge deal and very well deserved. It strikes me that those of us who ended up doing non-mainstream economics arrived at their destination via very different routes and often with a good deal of luck tossed in. And I was wondering what your story was. How did you come to economics in the first place? When did it take a heterodox turn? And can you give us a bit of a timeline regarding the line or lines of research that led to the Veblen Commons Award?
Okay, sure. I went to a cluster college, Callison College at University of the Pacific, for my undergraduate degree, and I didn't study any economics at all. We actually didn't have any majors. We studied the social sciences and the humanities, and I guess I took two courses you could call psychology courses. I took a couple of courses on Gandhi, and a couple of courses on literature. And one of those, I think, was called The Great American Novel or something like that. Two of the authors that really impressed me was Mark Twain, who of course I had read as a kid, but then reading them again as a college student, they had a bigger impact on me. But Kurt Vonnegut was new to me and extremely influential. And maybe you remember the title of my talk for the Feldman Commons Award, which was Womp Eaters, FOMA, and Grand Falloons, which of course comes straight out of Vonnegut. And what it tries to do is to take what I learned from Vonnegut and also from Veblen, because I saw when I later came across Veblen, I saw lots of similarities, and of course their heritage was similar too, and they both were sort of outsiders in America, studying these strange people we can call Americans. So anyway, and I also went through the School of Education at that time. I was going to be an elementary school teacher. I did my student teaching in Mexico City. When I came back, it was in the middle of the worst recession we had had since the Great Depression. And we also happened to have a teacher glut, which is a very unusual thing. Usually there's a shortage, but there was a glut. I could not get a job as a teacher. I ended up in Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter was elected in 76. There was already the CETA program, which was for long-term unemployed, but Carter increased the funding for it. And I got into CETA. I worked for the local government in public works, writing the specifications for garbage trucks, and developing the one of the first curbside recycling programs in the United
Really?
States. I think it was number three, the
Yeah.
third one. So, and then I started taking courses at night at California State University, Sacramento. And before I get into who was there, as a result of that switch and started studying economics and getting to know one of the professors, Susan McGowan, who worked in the California Energy Commission, I got a job with the California Energy Commission, which was a fantastic place to be. This was when we had Governor Moonbeam Brown, his
Right.
first terms, and he was 50 years ahead of his time, pushing for energy conservation. And what we did was we projected energy use, and I had the California agricultural sector. So it was lots of fun. But anyway, at Sac State, it turned out to be a very unusual department because it was full of heterodox economists, Marxists, institutionalists, and true to Keynesians. And the most influential were Mark Toole, who was the institutionalist, and he had just become the editor of the Journal of Economic Issues. He had been a student of Fag Foster, who was associated with Ayers. And so he came out of that tradition of institutional economics.
Well, so let me interrupt you real quick. Was it chance that you selected that institution?
I worked sort of up the road from California State University, because I was working in originally in the county public works, and then I was working downtown for the state. So it was the big school in the area.
So it was
And
sheer
why
chance.
economics? Why economics? Because when I was working for the county, I had found out they would pay my school fees if I had a job, courses related to my job. So I asked my boss, and he was an engineer, but he had just taken a couple of econ courses and he really liked them. So he suggested econ, and that's why I did it.
That's incredible. To think that you end up winning the Veblen Commons Award and you just go to that institution just because that's where you had to get a job when you were under this long-term unemployment thing. So, and that's why I wanted to ask this question. Obviously, we're not done yet, but just the interplay of all the luck that's involved. My dad got transferred halfway through my sophomore year of high school to Knoxville, and I ended up at UT because it was closer to my house than my high school. So, anyway, go ahead.
On that, so both of us know a lot of heterodox economists. And as you said, I think very few of them went straight through school and just learned whatever they needed to get their degree and graduated at 22, and then maybe at 26 they got a PhD. For me, I was late 20s before I took my first econ course. In the beginning, I did not have the people I'm going to be talking about because since I had no econ, I had to take principles and all of that stuff. And that was all very mainstream. I really hated the macro because it was so silly. I loved the micro, not because I thought any of it was correct. I knew it was all wrong, but it was easy. It was just math. You always knew what the right answer was, so you could whiz through that stuff. But anyway, so getting back, the second influential person was Joe Furey, who taught the first semester econ history of econ thought course, and he was a Marxist. So we read everything up to and including Marx with him. The second semester was John Henry, who started with the neoclassicals and then taught Keynes. And Keynes was the end of it. So it was neoclassical to Keynes. And the neoclassical was based on his book that came out later, The Making of Neoclassical Economics. So obviously very critical. And then Keynes. So Keynes was the, when reading the general theory was the first time that I got any macro that I had any interest in at all. It just made sense. Theory of effective demand, you have to start at the aggregate level. You can't start at the individual level and add up because you just get all sorts of fallacies. And finally, with Fury, in addition to the history of thought, he also taught econ history. And in there, we started with Morgan, Lewis Henry Morgan, Ancient Society. So we studied tribal society, and that ended up being very important for working on the origins of money and the barter story and all of that, because I knew how to try, as well as we can know how tribal society operated, and knew that that couldn't have been correct. It's completely inconsistent with the institutions you have in tribal society. And so, there's a very good connection between the what the Marxists were teaching and what Mark Toole was teaching. Even though you knew Mark Toole, he was not a fan of Marx. He wasn't a fan of any ism. He wouldn't even like it if you said institutionalism.
Really? I didn't know that.
He was opposed to it. When he lectured, you could not sit in the front row, no matter how much you liked the course, because he was like a holy roly preacher. And he would just rail against isms.
Oh, really? You saw that as a ceremonial valuing of some sort?
It's blocking everything off. For him, what economics is, it's about problem solving. And he's willing to listen to anyone's attempt to solve problems as long as it's through institutional adjustment and all that. So he didn't want a a set body of belief. That's what he was against. And then so all of this occurred before PhD. It was Toole and Henry that kept telling me to go to a PhD program. I still thought I was going to be an elementary school teacher. I took virtually every course. I think I had 170 units in econ,
No kidding.
almost every course that was there because I was still working and just going to school at night. Finally, I did apply, and it was Henry who said I should go study with Minsky. It wasn't that I had read Minsky yet. It was just Henry said Minsky is the best Keynesian there is, so you should go there. And then from Minsky, I got the, stability is destabilizing, and the banks don't lend money. They make payments for the customers and all that stuff.
Well, that's really interesting because, Henry, of course, pushed Stephanie Kelton into economics and getting a PhD. And for me, I was a physics major first because I'd grown up with the space race. And so I wanted to be an astronaut, really. I didn't realize that physics wasn't the route to being an astronaut, but nevertheless. And I found physics god-awful boring. Didn't mind the math. Went to political science, which I enjoyed enough to do a double major in. But then I took, do you remember Hans Jensen at Tennessee? He was my mentor. And I took the very first class I took was his introductory level history of economic thought class. And then I was done. This is what I've been looking for all my life. I just didn't know it. But again, just from the sheer accident of my dad being transferred to Knoxville, Tennessee, otherwise, I have no idea where I would have ended up. I assume you feel the same way. I would not have wanted to have ended up anywhere else than where I did. This has been exactly what I wanted to do with my life. I just didn't know it yet. Well, what about in terms of what you were feted for in terms of the award, what did they focus on specifically, and how did you get to that point? I guess we're talking about the history of money and MMT and so forth there.
Well, I'm not really sure why I was chosen. I published a lot in the JEI early on. I was mostly doing, I think, institutional economics, broadly defined. Then I got more focused on money, the nature of money, the origins of money, probably a bit more post-Keynesian. Because the endogenous money approach was being developed by the post-Keynesians, publishing more in the post-Keynesian journals for a while. But I had always done, I think, institutional related work, much more on banking, financial system in the past few decades.
I had a chance to see Finding the Money a couple of weeks ago, and you talked in there about having, I guess, the post-Keynesian thought email list had started up. And Warren Mosler kept posting things, and you kept saying to yourself, "Well, what the heck is he talking about?" When you did your Understanding Modern Money, though, how does that line up calendar-wise? Because it seemed to me like there were a whole lot of things you were already talking about that were along the lines of what Warren Mosler was saying. That it wasn't really—I mean, it came out in the film like it was entirely a surprise to you, but that doesn't ring true for me.
Yeah, it's not quite true. For my 1990 book, which was my dissertation, I had gone back to the origins of money. I was going to begin my dissertation and later the book with the origins of money, and I'm trying to destroy the barter story. And that goes back to my understanding of tribal society. But there also was another chance meeting, which is that Otto Steiger, I was writing my dissertation in Italy, and I think Jan invited Otto Steiger to come, and I sat in Jan's office and talked to Steiger, and he and Heinsohn had written this paper linking the origins of money to the rise of private property. Now, there were parts of their story that I don't buy. Trying to find private property 4,000 years ago. But they had a very interesting origin story. And at the time, I was reading Keynes's Treatise on Money because he also speculated on the origins of money. And there was a similarity was that all of the early money units were always a grain unit. The grain unit that they used to measure quantities of grain was adopted as the money unit too. So the shekel, the mina, and of course the pound and the lira, which means pound. All of the early money units were weight units. And so they had a story about how that happened through Keynes's Treatise on Money and talking to Otto. I started reading Knapp, the state theory of money. So my first book actually goes through the state theory of money. and the private property theory of money. It was a little bit after that, and I don't remember how, whether it came from Otto or not, I discovered A. Mitchell Innes, who has the clearest statement, much clearer than Knapp, much easier to read, on the state theory of money. But he also links it to the credit theory of money. So many people separate those two. There's a state theory of money, there's a credit theory of money. You can't put those two things together.
Yeah.
But he put them together. And it that made sense.
Yeah.
Minsky had always said, he didn't say taxes drive money, but he'd always described it as the reason why people want the government's money is because they have to pay tax. So I had heard that from Minsky. The reason why people want the bank's money is because they have loans from the banks. They need the bank money to pay their loan. So all of that was there. And then the final piece, a link with Stephanie, who you mentioned, we happen to both have the same money and banking teacher. She went to Sacramento State, maybe 15, 20 years after me. I'm not sure the number of years, but she had Randlett too. And we had to go through the balance sheets, including the balance sheets of when the government spends. And so I knew about the tax and loan accounts. I knew about the Treasury's government account at the Fed. And so I had some idea of how the government spent. And recently I found my lecture notes from 1991, where I went through all of this for the students on the blackboard.
Right, right.
So when Warren came on, it wasn't that any piece of what he said was new. It was that he had linked it all together. So taxes drive money, and bond sales are just a reserve drain. And linking those two things together, bonds are not borrowing. Now, I knew that when you sell bonds, you're draining reserves. But then making the leap to say the government doesn't borrow its own money. Of course, it makes perfect sense once you understand that. So I knew how to do all the balance sheets. But the way Warren had integrated everything and to some degree simplified just made it so much more obvious. In 1991, I had written a sarcastic paper that got published in, I think, in Challenge, arguing to abolish taxes. And the reason was because we had deficit hysteria, debt hysteria. I said, let's just abolish taxes. Don't worry about it, because I knew the government didn't need tax revenue to spend. But of course, we need taxes for other purposes. And I knew that. I was joking around. So yes, all of the pieces were there, but Warren put it together.
So anyway, well, you know, going back to, I guess, the very first podcast I did for Levy and talking to Jamie Galbraith, years ago, I was asking him at one of his conferences, you know, what do you think the chances are of saving the economics discipline? And he said, oh, none. They're gone. And what is your view of that? That you know, screw them. We just need to get on with our own jobs. But they're gone.
Well, Anne Mayhew used to have that view, too. And she used to say that we need to get out of the econ departments and into something else.
I think she ended up in the history department at Tennessee.
Economics is a very strange discipline. So when I taught at University of Denver, we had a core freshman course that had all of the social science disciplines represented there. And from the econ department, I taught it. So I taught the other disciplines too. We had a shared reading collection. So sociology would teach the course, political science would teach the course, anthropology would teach the course, and we had shared readings. And what was obvious and strange was that econ, typically, there is only one approach, the neoclassical approach. All the textbooks, there's only one approach, the neoclassical approach. That does not exist in the other social sciences. The other social sciences, political science, sociology, you will study Marx.
Right.
Econ, You will not study Marx. So econ was very, very different. I think political science also is changing a bit too and becoming more exclusionary.
Right.
But that wasn't true in the past. And it wasn't true in the past for econ either. But as you know, in econ, we've gotten rid of history of thought. And all of the top universities is not taught anymore.
Right.
And basically, macro's not taught anymore either.
I was just going to bring that up. That one of Colander's follow-up articles said that there are top institutions considering no longer including macro in the core set of courses. I mean, can you imagine a person on the street realizing that someone who just got a PhD from MIT or whatever doesn't really hasn't really studied unemployment or inflation or interest rates? It's unbelievable.
It's true, and the places that still do have a macro course, they can't hire teachers because there aren't any. There are no students coming out. Now, in heterodoxy, of course, it's different, but that's not who they're looking for. They're looking for mainstream macro, and they can't find them because they're not being produced. Just if you tried to hire a historian of thought, you're not going to find one. They don't exist. Economic history, you're not going to find them. So you have to hire a real historian, which is not a bad thing if
But nevertheless, a terrible testament. So you do feel then that it's worth continuing the fight to impact the discipline itself.
at UMKC, I don't know the exact number of PhD students we produced, but it was a tremendous number. I'm pretty sure that I was on 50 dissertations. Some number like that. It's a huge number. They all got jobs. All of them
Well, there you
are
go.
somewhere. And almost, I think a few maybe took academic positions, then took a different one. But they're in colleges all over the place. And they're mostly in econ departments. So, no, I don't think we need. I mean, it's one thing to say we're going to give up on the discipline as taught in the top ranked universities and published in the top ranked journals. Yeah, that stuff is completely irrelevant.
And that's an interesting point that you bring up then. And it makes me think about something that happened to me, and I may have brought it up in one of the earlier podcasts, but I think it's especially relevant here. Do you remember Chris Brown at Arkansas State? He was the editor of the JEI for a while. He was across the hall from me in grad school. And when Paul Davidson got to Tennessee, he and I were invited to go out to lunch with Davidson and Alfred Eichner and Mayhew and Terry Neal. And of course, this was incredible to us. And we sat there very quietly the whole time in awe. But the conversation went like this. Somebody brought up, remember back when we thought we could change things and we didn't? And I thought, oh, great. Here I am starting off my PhD and I'm finding out from these people I look up to that they feel like what they did was futile. But it wasn't. It wasn't. It was because of people like them who continued to work to put out these ideas, people like John Henry, that people like Stephanie Kelton and Randy Ray and John Harvey, that they exist. That even though we went through a horrible, horrible period, now MMT is something that is so dangerous that Congress wants to pass a law against it. And so, as a consequence, I see your point. I had been leaning more the Galbraith direction, but I see your point. If we give up on pushing this, then who knows what the future generations can accomplish once you and I are in our Winnebagoes and retired. This is very important to keep to pass the torch on. So I stand corrected. Well, going back to our interactions at the AFI conferences, I don't know if you remember, but you and I were the two discussants on a panel. I had to look it up and I found the exact date and everything on central banking and free banking in 1996 in San Francisco. And one of the papers was from George Selgin, who was an Austrian, a very nice man. But you took exception to his analysis and you really tore into him. All right, let's just put it that way. And the reason I bring this up is that for many years, I have used that interaction as an example to my students. And I was very curious to see whether or not you agree with my assessment or agree with the lesson I'm trying to give my students with this. And what I've been telling my students is that you two weren't really talking about the specific thing where you disagreed, at least not at the most fundamental level. It was about the origin of money. And it seemed to me that Selgin tried to reverse engineer the origins of money. Money does this today. Therefore, we must have had problems with those things in the past. And, you know, and that's how money came about. Whereas you were citing historical evidence. Well, we have records of credit being used going back centuries. And, you know, in Germany, so-and-so happened and so forth. And what I kept thinking during your presentation was that you're really disagreeing about what do I find convincing as evidence. And Selgin really didn't care about historical evidence. And you were more along the lines of, well, you can't just make it up. And there is actually some, you know, links here to the history of economics. Adam Smith was heavily influenced by the Scottish common sense philosophy, where we can't trust our senses. So looking at historical record, in fact, Mayhew, when I took her economic history class, there was a paper on what can the numbers tell us about slavery. And the object of the paper was to say, well, you got to be careful. Because what the slave owners wrote down and what's useful data to you and me ain't the same thing, right? People are influenced by different things. So you know, Selgin takes a sort of heavily, well, we can't trust that evidence. Yeah, sure, you read that in a book somewhere, but they weren't thinking, oh my gosh, one day Randy Ray will need this to talk about the origin of money and all kinds of other factors that affect it. Whereas you're thinking, if I'm not mistaken, oh my God, we can't just make it up. Because we are too heavily influenced by our biases when we reverse engineer a story. And I'm wondering if that has any relevance whatsoever to your approach into how, and you know George Selgin, I think, fairly well, to how he approaches things.
Yeah. Well, so reverse engineer that is the barter story. So right. The barter story is based on this view. Okay, so in our economy today, we use money. Let's imagine an economy that is almost exactly like ours, or at least like we would like to think ours operates, but remove money. How could they get by? Well, they would have to barter, okay? Right. And so this is exactly what the neoclassical barter story is, and that is what George was doing. Now, up to that point, I did not realize that was what George was doing. Because there's the free banking school, I knew about it. They argue that back when we had free banking, life was glorious, it was a fantastic period, then the evil government came along and took control of the money, right?
Yeah.
And so I knew the story, but I also knew the historical critique of it.
Yeah.
And it was only during this argument with him when finally he said, oh, you thought I was talking about history? No, I was talking about the way things might have been.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that was a real revelation to me.
Yeah.
That they weren't trying, although they were always sly about this.
Yeah.
Because they were pretending as if they were doing history, but really they weren't.
Yeah.
It's just the way that you do the, you know, the origins of money, you just make it up.
Right. But you initially assumed they were taking the same approach you were, but drawing from different sources, perhaps.
Yes, I had thought that had some kind of evidence, but no evidence at all. It's just a logical statement. And so my view is that logic by itself is absolutely useless because, as Joan Robinson said, the conclusions are contained in the assumptions. So you start off with the assumptions. You know, people are naturally greedy and they have a natural propensity to truck and barter.
Right.
And if there is no money, how do they do it? Well, okay, we can tell the story. But you don't gain any knowledge. You can perhaps be logical, but you haven't gained any knowledge of the way that things work.
Right.
And even agreeing with Anne Mayhew, even observation can't tell you anything. You have to have a framework.
Yes.
So, you know, the story of people who were blind at birth, and then later on, a medical procedure is developed so that they suddenly can see, but they actually cannot see. So even though the light is now going in and hitting the optic nerves, they can't make any sense of what they see. You have to have a view
Reference.
as to what the world is all about
Right,
in order to
right.
be able to see it. And what that means is you have to have a paradigm.
Right, right, right.
So logic alone doesn't help you, and even just observation alone doesn't help you. You have to put everything that you see into some kind of a framework. It's very difficult to describe how you develop the framework. I like Kuhn. I think that even though there is some
Yeah.
criticism of applying Kuhn to social science,
Right.
but I still think it is largely the right way to go about it.
You think it's an iterative process then, that you have a theory, you look at the real world. How well does it explain the real world? Oh, it doesn't. This part doesn't work, and we go back and fix it, and back and forth and back. But then ultimately, as opposed to Friedman, where the ultimate test of a theory is its, ability to predict, which they never ever do, incidentally, of course. But for us, the ultimate ability, of a theory is, I tell my students, if you build a model of the Great Depression, of the economy during the Great Depression, and it comes out with 4% unemployment, it's not a good model. All right. So yeah, that's not going to work. It has to, does it have to be exact same level of employment? Well, that would be nice. Yeah, that if it doesn't explain history, then it sure as hell can't explain the future. And you were talking about reverse engineering things. My God, neoclassical trade theory is nothing but reverse engineering, because the whole theory of comparative advantage assumes an autarkic world where we don't know what no countries trade with each other yet. And so we have to assume, okay, well, X amount of labor would create, wine, and X amount would create cloth. But then once we raise the borders, well, now England no longer makes wine at all, and Portugal no longer makes cloth at all. So there's no way to test comparative advantage, because they now do trade with one another, or even with increasing returns or whatever. And I have a class where I do a sort of comparative advantage of international economics, and I said, so this. It's an interesting story, comparative advantage. And I can see some places where it might have some applicability, but it is totally and completely untestable, because it posits a world that doesn't exist. And that is perfectly okay in neoclassicism. But on the other hand, you're going to get a tough time getting a publication in the Journal of Economic Issues or the Journal of Post-Keynesian Economics with that kind of approach. And that's kind of how I saw Selgin.
Let me say just a little bit more about George Selgin, though,
Yeah.
because he actually has done very good historical research. Okay.
Yeah.
His book, I think the title is Good Money. Maybe it has a subtitle too,
Yeah.
around 2008, I think. I reviewed it. It's actually excellent. It's the history of private coinage in Britain. And making copper coins. And it's very interesting. It's all tied up with the rise of breweries,
Right. Really? Huh.
and the brewers had to pay their workers wages.
Yeah.
They would have a private mint that made copper coin. They would pay the workers the copper coin
Yeah.
so that they could buy the beer at the brew pub.
Right.
And so you had this nice closed circle of the whole thing operating on the basis of private coinage.
Interesting.
It's a very good book.
He seems like an extremely nice man, because at the time, one of our faculty had studied under him, and so I made a point of introducing myself at the session. So I'm glad to hear that he's done some good stuff, and that it's grounded in something reasonable and logical.
He's also in the MMT documentary.
Yes,
And
he was.
he's asked, is there anything wrong with MMT? No, he said it's all correct. He said
Yeah.
maybe he might change the emphasis of some of the things, but it's all
Yeah.
correct.
No, when I was watching it, I thought, uh-oh, when he came on the screen. And then he's like, oh no, exactly as you say. He said, nothing wrong with it. So, that's another mark in his favor. Do you remember back in the 1980s, this whole push for the micro foundations of macroeconomics? And you had mentioned earlier the sort of shift of trying to analyze the government as if it were a household. And that reminded me of that as another one of the things that really just destroyed neoclassical macro in my mind, was this whole, micro foundations thing. And then eventually we get, I'm sure you've seen Paul Romer's article on the trouble with macroeconomics, where he says that the macroeconomics of the last 3 decades has ceased to be scientific undertaking, which there's nothing more damning you could say to another scholar than that. He ends up coming around to, but really what's going on is interest rates are driving everything. So I don't agree with that, but I certainly strongly agree with his view that macroeconomists have stopped worrying about whether or not, in neoclassical economics, whether or not their theories have anything to do with, and I think his phrase he uses repeatedly is the actions that people take, that there's no concern anymore with the human behavior. And I saw him at a conference before he got the Nobel Prize, but after this article had come out, and he said that he had caught all kinds of hell for it. None of the criticism was, "You're wrong." The criticism was, "How dare you say something like that about our revered leaders?" And I suppose that happens in every school of thought. We have ancestor worship, but to me, that was really it was hopeful in one way, in that this Nobel Prize winner or eventual Nobel Prize winner was saying something so bold about the state of economics. But then on the other hand, we've got the people bouncing back saying, "How dare you say that about Lucas and Friedman and so forth." I don't know if you have any comments on that. Maybe it's such a shame.
What they've done is they've gone back to the state of one particular branch of economics, which was the neoclassical branch, which
Right.
actually wasn't even dominant in the United States. It was dominant in
Right.
Britain. They've gone back to that, but they've made it much more ridiculous by adding rational expectations, continuous market clearing. So it's like super duper neoclassical on steroids.
Right.
And what Keynes was doing, and what Marx and Veblen were doing too, not as successfully in terms of influencing the profession.
Yeah.
Keynes was writing a revolution, and this is what he told George Bernard Shaw,
Right.
that the book I am writing is going to revolutionize economic theory, maybe not all at once, but eventually. And this is what he thought he was doing. And what that was macroeconomics.
Yeah.
It was saying that you can't start with the individual utility maximizer, individual firm, or individual
Right.
market, that you've got to start at the macro level. You get all sorts of problems if you try to aggregate up
Right.
because you have to assume a complete independence. But basically, what he's saying is that when you do the supply, so everybody knows supply and demand, right?
Yeah.
Because that's what you're taught in the basic macro courses. He's saying you can't draw those supply and demand curves as being fixed. While you move one curve, the other one doesn't move.
Right,
You
right,
can't
right.
do that. It's actually a logical fallacy. And neoclassical economists want to use logic and insist that they are very logical, but from the get-go, their approach is illogical. You can't shift one curve without impacting the other. And this is what the revolution is all about.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us today, Randy. To our listeners, we hope you've enjoyed our conversation today. Please give us a rating and let us know your thoughts. And as a reminder, check out the show notes for links to the Levy graduate programs and upcoming events, including the Levy Institute's annual conference. We hope to see you there. You can follow the Levy Institute on Twitter slash X, Instagram, and Facebook at Levy Econ, at symbol LEVYECON. You can also subscribe to the Institute's newsletter at levyinstitute.org. Please see the show notes for some of our recommended publications for further reading on this topic and links to some of Professor Ray's work. Stay tuned. Thank you.